The story of the radiators.
Hello everybody, my name is Roisin Dwyer and I'd like to thank
Shut Niall the fuck up, she's talking.
Niall and Michael for asking me to host a couple of panels. Firstly, I'm going to talk to Pete and Steve specifically about the radiators, and then I'm going to invite Kitty Kavanagh up and we're going to broaden the discussion into a bit more of a chat about Ireland in 77 and the punk scene here. So let's kick it off with the story of the radiators. But before the radiators, there was Greta garbage in the trash cans. Let's go back in time to 1975 and tell me, like, how were the seeds of the radiators sown then? How did you get from Greta to the radiators?
Well, I was in love with music, in love with the kind of energy music, and couldn't play, I couldn't sing, so I had to form my own band and find people to do that. So the original lineup of Greta Garbage was Billy Morley, the late Billy Morley on guitar, amazing guitar player, and a guy called, excuse me, Dave McGavin, who played bass. And Pete was involved as well for a while, but then he went back to live in London, so he kind of stepped out for a little while. And then as we couldn't find people who were interested in the music, either to join the band or anywhere to do gigs, so we made one video for RTE of a song called The Girl with the Luminous Brain.
Which I believe is on SoundCloud. I was listening to it this morning.
Yeah. It was written and recorded in 3 hours for an RTE show. They just got on camera and says, would you go on the show? And we filmed it out in the power station in Ringsend. So it was kind of a...
That was much later, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was later. It was actually somebody came back and said, did you have anything to record? So really what happened was Billy decided he was getting fed up with this getting nowhere and he left the band. So I went looking for new people to join, and I found Pete, and then I found Philip.
But it was, you put an ad in, was it Faulkner O'Kelly's Rock Column, and that was how you both found Philip?
Philip, yeah.
Bring us back to the time you actually met Philip, the very first meeting.
Well,
what was your impression?
Pete and I were in my house then in Portmarnock, and Philip arrived on a little, we had this little put up the driveway, and a guy came in this big helmet, small head, big gold tooth, and you think, oh, you know, this is very weird. And he sat down at the table and he played two songs, one of which we both remember, called Tin Pan Alley Cats, which was, we knew immediately this guy has got talent, but we weren't sure that he was the right person for what we wanted to do, because we were looking for a lead guitar player. And Philip said he wasn't a lead guitar player. So we said, okay, fine, we'll continue our search for a guitar player. But then I think within 2 weeks, I said to Pete, look, this is crazy. This guy, he's been in the 100 Club, he's seen the Sex Pistols, he knows exactly what we're about. So I rang Philip and said, would you have a go at the lead guitar and what you're doing? So he said, yeah, I'll give it a go. So it was a crazy time for about 6 months, because we didn't know whether a solo from Philip was going to be amazing or awful. And it was a bit of both, and it was great. But the ironic thing is, of course, is Pete suddenly switched over at some point and became the guitar player, and Philip went on to rhythm as he concentrated on his vocals.
And like, bring us back to those early rehearsals. Like, did you know from the first time, you know, rehearsing you guys together, wow, there's something really special here?
Well, one of the benefits of Philip joining the band is that he knew Mark and Jimmy Crash, Mark and Jimmy Crash, so he brought them. We all agreed to rehearse in Steve's real garage. And I think we had this agreement that we would record these rehearsals. We still have these rehearsal recordings. They're incredible, actually. This free-flowing, experimental...
Garage Band 1.
Garage Band 1. And so we recorded them, and just you know, it could be cover versions and stuff like that. You know, the MC5 and the Iggy and the Stooges. New York Dolls, you know, because just going back to Greta Garbage and the Trash Cans, because, you know, that influence is obviously like glam rock, you know, because I think most of the original punks were very much influenced by the glam rock scene.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that's sort of 5 years before them, you know.
Yeah.
So we rehearsed, we recorded rehearsals, and then we said that we'd keep going for a few weeks and then maybe record again and compare the two. And if there's no real improvement, we said we'd just call it a day, you know. But we just felt it was, we just felt there was a great something, you know, it's something you couldn't, intangible. It's just maybe the five characters, because, you know, because if you were to analyse the radiator's sound, which you may or may not do, you certainly, what you'd find would be Jimmy Crash, he was very much into jazz, you know, jazzy chops on drums. Mark Magray was very much into roots and black music and Motown, so he's quite, you know, a lot of his bass lines, so, you know, he was the sort of the musical element of certainly of TVG Park, where his bass lines were, you know, very melodic and tuneful. And that sort of allowed myself and Philip really sort of, and Steve, to sort of to trash out and give those, you know, the venom side of the form, I suppose.
Sure. And like, how difficult was it to get gigs in Dublin back in that time?
But it's like everything else. It was sort of the do-it-yourself era, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. There was nowhere to play. The first time we did a gig in town, well, our very first gig was with Eddie and the Hot Rods.
In UCD?
In UCD.
How did you get that? Very prestigious debut live.
I think Steve rang up.
Did Philip
bring up the promoter?
Yeah, Philip and we followed up and we sort of got the gig and we said we're the only punk band, you know, in our. Mind you, we didn't call ourselves a punk band in those days.
Yeah.
We were just a high energy rock band, because all those bands like Dr. Feelgood, Eddie and the Hot Rods were kind of high energy R&B bands.
But actually, that's interesting. Why did you not call yourselves punk? Why did you not want to?
Because the term was a media invention, in a sense.
Okay. Like
nobody called us a punk band when they started. It was applied to us.
Right.
We're talking 75, 76 now. It's really towards the late 76 at the punk thing. That came to us.
We call it as a white suburban punk blues band.
Okay, a white suburban punk blues band. Very impressive. And like, it's interesting, I was just thinking about the different scenes around Ireland. Like, when the Undertones played their first Dublin show, it was with you guys. So what was it like them coming from Derry down to Dublin? Was there a camaraderie between the different scenes around the country?
It was a case where it's a fellow, Donald McDermott, was in a band called Dick Tracy and the Green Zars, if I remember rightly. He was actually at Trinity College, and Philip knew him and met him, and he mentioned about this band up in Derry called the Undertones, that any time they played a gig, they were sort of bombarded with glasses and booed and jeered, and the power supply pulled out. So we invite them to come down. You know, so we met them in Dublin. We brought them down to play a gig in the Bagot Inn, the first time they played with us. And we met them in town. They were off the train with their sort of guitars and cardboard boxes and bits of string wrapped around them, and we met them and they started talking, and they were talking for maybe 20 minutes and I did not have a clue what they were saying. And we just sort of nodded and said yes, you know. And eventually we told them where the Bagot Inn was, and they arrived at the Bagot Inn. I remember it as if it was yesterday. They arrived at the Bagot Inn and we were doing a sound check, and we could see that they were looking at, oh my God. And then we did our sound check, and then they just unwrapped their guitars, you know, unwrapped the string of their cardboard boxes, and they got on stage, and Pish Fish, as it was called then, which is Fergal Sharkey, was called Pish Fish, or Pash Fash, actually. He just went, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we went, holy shit.
Yeah.
They were brilliant.
Yeah.
They were great. I suppose really, we immediately sort of bonded, you know. We had a common goal, I suppose, a common cause, and it's something that continues through to this day, really.
But was there a sense of frustration, a shared sense of frustration, in terms of how you were being treated by the mainstream, or was it what was the feeling of both camps?
No, we weren't treated too bad by the mainstream. You know, I certainly remember myself and Philip got the bus out to RTE and went to the cafe in RTE and started acting like punks, as you did last night, to try and grab a bit of attention. And yeah, we weren't thrown out. You know?
Yeah, but so there was there was a famous gig in the Asgard in Howth where the whole audience walked out.
Yeah,
tell us about that.
Well, what happened? I mean, in fairness, we were rehearsing Sunday afternoon in my garage, and a call came in to Philip and said, "Look, this band was playing the Asgard was unable to do it, and the promoter was unable to get anybody else to do it." So he asked Philip, because Philip and myself would ring around the promoter and say, "Any chance of a gig?" And this guy says, "Well, can you guys come over?" So we went back in the room and said, "Yeah, let's go and do it." I mean, because this meant a PA and microphones and things, which we didn't normally have. We all sort of crowded around one microphone in the garage and did it that way. So at punk had sort of more or less taken hold. We were sort of trying to defray the use of swastikas and things in punk imagery. So I'd created this kind of jagged lightning strike thing, which is kind of like Blitzkrieg rock,
yeah,
and a feel to it. And it was a symbol which we dropped after a couple of gigs because we realized people were misinterpreting what we were trying to do. But anyway, I got reels and reels of red wallpaper. We hung it all the way down the hall with these swastikas that looked like the Nuremberg rally when we came in. We all,
as you do,
exactly. And the audience came in, and obviously the band that was booked to play was an Eagles type band. So they all sat down and looked at us, and we went 1, 2, 3, 4, we went wham. And then 3 songs later, the place was not being the entire audience had left us.
Mission accomplished. Yeah. And one man who gave you his blessing and was a big fan and brought you out on the Bad Reputation tour was Phil Lynott. Well, what brilliant lessons did Phil give you?
My nostrils are still sore, that's for sure. It was that time where we had released 2 singles, Television Screen and Enemies, in the UK without having ever been there.
Mm.
And I mean, all the punk bands that were active, you could see in and around Dublin continuously. And even when we arrived in London, it would be in September '77.
Mm.
The first thing we did there, we played 12 gigs around London, and this was the first time that we had, you know, quite a lot of publicity, even in the UK, with Chiswick and Stiff Records being sort of, I suppose, the two cool labels. And so on those 12 gigs, I mean, they were all sort of fairly well attended, and amongst the audiences in quite a lot of those gigs, we found a lot of the other bands were turning out to check us out. Like, you know, you could do a gig and there'd be a Sex Pistol there and a member of the Clash there, and
yeah,
gave a bit of Damned. And one of those, Phil Lynott, turned up at one of those gigs as well. But to cut the long story short, there was a connection between the record company, Ted Carroll and Roger Armstrong, and Thin Lizzy's then managers. And I think it was in many ways, it was a good move for Thin Lizzy to have a punk band on the tour.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it showed themselves aligning with, you know, this new,
sure,
music form, and they didn't want to be regarded as not rock dinosaurs, all that type of thing.
Yeah.
And so it was cool for them. For our point of view, obviously, it would bring us to a much bigger audience, and little did we know what would unfold, you know, because I think the further we accepted to do the tour on one condition, that we got to meet Tony Visconti at the end of the tour, who was working on the Live and Dangerous album.
Yeah, yeah.
So it brought us to a bigger audience, but it didn't bring us to our audience, it brought us to Thin Lizzy's audience, you know.
Right.
But we did learn certainly to project, you know, to the back of a large hall and stuff,
yeah,
like that. So I think the band that came out of that tour, in terms of tightness, and you know, I think unless you do like 28 gigs in 30 days, I think, you know, any band that does that is a completely different band that finishes it. You know, you're really on a almost like telepathic level, you know,
yeah,
that you can't possibly achieve in a rehearsal room or one-off gigs, you know.
Yeah.
So we learned a lot, you know, and to be fair to Philip Lynott, he was very supportive of young emerging Irish acts, regardless of what their musical style was, you know. But we had problems, you know, like we were booed onto the stage in Glasgow. The second concert, which was in Glasgow, we were used to being loved, and we walked onto this negative boos, you know,
yeah,
and we just sort of had to get a head around that. It didn't happen again until Birmingham.
Right.
And by that time we sort of thought about it, and because the first time we sort of froze, the second time we just really gave it back.
Mm.
And you know, so it was a good learning curve, I think,
yeah,
overall.
Yeah.
The visit.
And actually, the one thing about Lizzy really was they were one of the only, them and Motorhead, maybe heavy rock bands to be embraced by the punk community. And of course, they went.
We actually did a gig with Motorhead as well.
Oh,
we did in one gig, because they were in Chiswick at the time. And it was a 2,000 capacity venue in Aylesbury Friars. They were louder in their dressing room, I say, than we were on stage. And there was 1,990 bikers and a couple of very pale punks in front of us. But we weren't bottled off stage, so we regard that as a major triumph.
Sure, yeah. And like Lizzy, of course, joined with some members of the Sex Pistols to form the Greedies, and you did the same yourselves and the Horse Lips formed the Meanies. How did that come about? Or what, did you just, it's time to get some trad in? Or what was the...
It was a Christmas gig, really, wasn't it? That we did, you know, we did a few things. I mean, I did another one as well, which was the Heat Benefit, with Eamon Carr and the guys in that band. So we were just doing a lot of gigs. I mean, in a funny way, Philip had asked us to be on the Dairyman concert.
Yeah.
And it was the first time. It was my last gig with the band, and the first time he had seen us. And it was through a lot of backstage manoeuvrings. And we were put on this position on the bill. And next thing we were down here, and then we were down here, and down here.
And the fact that Bob Geldof was on the bill has absolutely
nothing to do with it, exactly. Philip was furious when he arrived. He was really pissed off that we were his special guests, and we were finished before we'd even gone on. So it was a kind of an unusual...
The stories we could tell you.
No, but like in terms of Irish rock history, you know, Dayman Park, August 77 is, you know, one of the first major outdoor concerts in Ireland. What are your memories of the day? Like, who else was on the bill? Lizzie, Graham Parker and the Rumour,
and
yourselves, Boomtown
Rats.
The Fairport Convention, Stagger Lee, and, you know, it was like four or five Irish bands, and there was a break, and then the international bands, and we were moved from the start of the international bands to the last of the Irish bands. But my abiding memory was climbing on top of a guitar amp, which somebody hadn't clamped the wheels on, and I started to move slowly towards the edge of the stage on top of this amp.
managed
to just get off the amp before we went over into the audience. But it was a good gig. It was one of those strange experiences. We'd always played in small clubs, and therefore you couldn't really hear yourself.
Yeah.
You walked on stage in Dairyman Park, and you had the mic go, boom, who's that? You could actually hear yourself for the first time, but it was a good final gig.
Yeah. So we are a few days off the actual 40th birthday of TV Tune Part.
Yes.
What did you say, Peter? The 7th of October? 6th of October?
The 7th, yeah.
7th, yeah. Like, what was... when, you know, obviously there's a sense of you're sort of in a studio with blinkers when you don't really know what you're creating. What was your set, like, how did you feel about the response to the album at the time after its release?
Well, unfortunately in the UK, because, you know, there was obviously an incident that happened, a stabbing, and unfortunately a student lost guy lost their life at one of our gigs, which... more or less, anyone that was close, there was people that were interested in the radio.
That was
suddenly,
the Belfield show,
they suddenly turned around and mile. Nobody wanted to know, you know, no one would book us for anything. This was in Ireland, obviously.
Yeah.
And, you know, we couldn't get a gig, you know, nobody wanted to know anymore. So, you know, what happened then was that it seemed that the record company felt it might be better to bring the album forward.
Mm.
So we recorded the album, I think we recorded the album before we were really mentally ready to do it. You know, we were doing it because there was nothing else sort of to do. You know?
Yeah.
And it was recorded in 3 days and you know, mixed, I'm not sure, you know, but it was done sort of very quickly. So, you know, it's rough around the edges, but, you know, it's just captured us as we were. So the reviews in the UK, there was one prominent review in the New Musical Express. And it was actually the lead review in the Musical Express, this is TV Tune Part by the Radiance of Space from Dublin. It was the lead review in the NME, and it spent half the review talking about them justifying splashing this murder in a tabloid fashion on the front cover of the NME. Do you know what I mean? So we felt a little bit of a dragged into something. We'd rather them talk about the album than talk about, you know, justifying their position. Now, I remember Bob Geldof did say, you know, it was in reference to the murder. He said it was the best thing that ever happened to us, you know. And knowing how his mind works, I can understand him saying it. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, you know, any publicity is good. But you know, I can assure you that I'd much rather Patrick Coltrane was still alive. You know?
Yeah, of course.
Do you know what I mean?
And how was it treated in the media at the time? Was it sort of sensationalised?
Well, it was to a degree, yeah. I mean, the news, some newspapers more or less said we were the band playing on stage when this happened, which was far from the truth. It happened in the very first... We had tried to put together a punk festival called Dublin's Burning. We had the Undertones, we had the Gamblers, we had the Vipers, we had Revolver. We had every band that we could have heard of, or we knew, that was playing new wave or punk on the one bill, including the Undertones. So that's what, and a lot of people who were at the gig have said to me afterwards, they didn't know anything had happened until police arrived at the very end of the gig.
Right.
Unfortunately, we knew what was going on. We had seen what had happened in the very first And it all happened in a very, very
quick. The reality is, stuff like that happens every Saturday night.
Yeah.
Simply, on that Saturday night happened, and in every Saturday night since then, it's more or less happened. Funny enough, in the Hot Press, well, one I think Niall was particularly good in putting that perspective on it.
Sure.
As we sort of reviewed sort of the fallout of the whole thing. You know, just something that happened, and we certainly didn't want to take any advantage from that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the truth is we broke up afterwards.
Right.
We couldn't for a while justify what had happened playing music. And then all people came to us and talked to us and said, well, you had nothing to do, you couldn't have done anything differently that would have prevented what happened. So we decided, let's carry on and let's do it. And in fact, as Pete said, it was Ted and Roger who really were instrumental in pushing us forward, because there are various people who had been in touch with us. One particular person who wanted to manage us never contacted us again. We never heard another word from them. And it was very hard, so we went in the studio and we made the album.
Anyway, we got through it, and you know, on a more positive thing, you know, we you know, I suppose we made the album. When the album, not universally, it's just NME's review gave them a chance to sort of, you know, wash their dirty laundry, etc. But yeah, I think the general overall view is, I think the very important thing that the British press picks up on in particular was the fact that, you know, the subject of, you know, the things that we were shouting about was relative to our life. You know, our punk agenda was different to, say, the UK punk agenda.
Yeah,
you know, they're shouting no future in any case in the UK.
Yeah.
We're talking about other things, you know, things that relate to us. So some of the journalists appreciated that, the fact that there was an Irish element to the lyrical content.
But also, very sonically, it was very different as well, though, in terms of like the harmonies and the arrangements. It was a lot more complex, I think, to a lot of the British punk, maybe. No? Is that oversimplifying
it? The Irishness comes out in Irish bands' music, no matter what they are, you know. So the fact that we're, you know, traditionally Irish people are storytellers, and traditionally Irish people have a sense of melody, naturally, etc. And you know, well, I don't see anything wrong with that coming out in a punk record.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the tracks on the album is actually based on an Irish traditional song, "Follow Me Up to Carlow." You know, and just gave it a bit of energy into the whole thing. I mean, the interesting thing about the 40th edition is, it's got, when we went in the studio on the first day, we recorded what was our live set, live in the studio. And some of the tracks from that are on the new edition.
Yeah.
So it's gone from 34 minutes to 71 minutes now, so it's kind of like a bit of, there's some, and the Vortex Club, there's some songs played in the Vortex Club tape. So it's quite an interesting.
And that 40th anniversary edition is available in all good record shops.
And bad ones sometimes. Bad ones.
is Kitty here? Can we bring Kitty up to have a chat? Kitty, come on up. Give a big round of applause for Kitty, everybody. So, Kitty, thank you for joining us. And there's a nice bit of synchronicity here, because it was Steve's ad in the second edition of the fanzine Heat, calling for female punk musicians, that was the catalyst for Boy Scouts. Tell us the story.
I didn't really have anything to do with that. That was Cathy Owens and Ed Darrow put the band together.
Yeah, they were the first two to come in, and then Eater was playing the drums.
Eater responded to the ad in Heat.
She came in. Yeah.
I remember hearing that she wrote, they were looking for a female drummer, and they received like this little brown paper sweet packet with yes written on it.
Right.
Yeah, anyway, the idea was just to get this band together, and I kind of acted as a catalyst for it to happen, and then I kind of withdrew. I didn't want to get involved in managing the band or telling them what to do, or I wanted them just to do whatever they want to do. And then you guys all got together and started to rehearse together, and you started to play gigs, which was a great thing. I mean, it was a really interesting band, because I saw you playing the Hove, you played with U2 in Black Rock Park and various other venues like that.
Oh yeah, remember that.
How was that? What is there a story there?
Some shenanigans going on regarding the PA, wasn't there? So the PA didn't turn up or something.
Oh, okay, I see.
But I think it was meant to be there all the time, I don't know. I was handed a microphone, and Bonner comes over to me and hands me a microphone with no top on it.
Mm.
And he says, you have to sing through a bass amp, because, you know, and he said, so I suggest you sing an octave higher. So I turn around to Carol, the guitarist, and what the fuck is an octave? But Cathy Owen started the band, and with Ed, they did a lot of the writing and everything. And then Cathy went off to study art in Belfast,
right.
And then they were looking for another singer, and that's when I came in, and it kind of changed then the sound and everything, because I was quite a different voice too.
Yeah, and what was your own background, or why did you want to get involved? Had you been in bands before?
No, I used to sing a lot at home.
Right, okay.
And my sister met Cathy Owens' brother, and they were looking for a singer, and she said, I got you an audition. I said, oh, I'm not doing an audition.
Right.
And she said, I'll buy you a nag and a vodka. So I said, okay.
Best way to start.
Yeah, and then I drank it in Carol's toilet, and it says top of the stairs. There's a toilet, and I sculled it, and then I come out of the loo and fell down the stairs, the whole way down the stairs, and her father was sitting on the end of the stairs on the phone, and he was just watching me, and I was falling very slowly, trying to stop, and then I finally ended up on the floor, and I went, hello.
Yeah. Great introduction.
And then we went in, and we didn't even talk. They just handed me some lyrics, and it was like 1, 2, 3, 4, and off we went.
Right.
And we just sort of looking at each other, and we just looked at certain...
Was there an immediate chemistry with you and them?
Yeah, immediate, yeah.
Mm, good. And like, I remember talking to Viv Albertine about her time in the Slits, and her saying, you know, she did used to get an awful lot of grief. Did you get grief as a female punk?
I know I gave grief.
Oh,
plenty
maybe
of
maybe that was the solution. Give it, don't take it.
Lots of grief.
Yeah.
Still doing it too.
Yeah.
I was morbidly obese, and I needed to tone down my attitude, and you know, I'd be told things like that all the time.
Oh.
Yeah. So generally, you know, people say things like that to me, and I just slap them.
Yeah. Well, deserved. A slap is deserved.
The knuckles never been the same since.
So yeah, like, paint a picture of Dublin at the time. Was there obviously the catalyst for the bands were, you know, ads in fanzines and magazines. Was it hard to meet like-minded people, like-minded punks?
It wasn't easy. No, there wasn't no network as such. I mean, the first time we played the Baggot Inn, they told us to go away for 5 years and learn to play. So, you know, it was a sort of, as Pete says, the musicians didn't really know what to make of us, because here was a band who'd got a record deal signed before they played their first gig, and that was totally unheard of, because these guys had been slogging the scene, playing the blues for 5 years, 10 years, and saying, well, how the hell does this band get this thing? So you've already got a certain infamy when you start off. But we tried to, we did our own fanzine called Raw Power, and through Raw Power we got that into the shops, and we got as many copies as we could, and that was a focal point. We sort of put writing addresses so people would get in touch through that, and that's the way we kind of built a network. But it was quite small. I mean, the fan base in, like, when we played the Warren's Hotel, which was our kind of prime club, there may have been 100 people, you know.
Right, okay.
Tight-knit little communities to start up. I mean, when we went in September, it's what seemed to flourish then in Ireland. But when we came back in, I think in December, to do a few gigs, the whole sort of scene had really taken off, you know, which is great.
Yeah, and it was like, you did your initial sessions were with Midnight, really, with Jackie Hayden and Eamon Carr.
Eamon Carr, I think, you know, has to be given some credit where he's very broad-minded in terms of, you know, his own sort of influences, and he became aware, that was Philip Chevron and Eamon knew each other for many years.
Yeah.
When, you know, Philip was just I think 15 or 16 year old kid, school kid doing an interview, you know. So anyway, Eamon got interested in the Radiators, and himself and Jackie Hayden funded the record, our very, very first recording session that was in Trend Studios. And it was like a day in the studio, lashed down a few tracks. And,
yeah.
We did Television Screen. What else we did? We did Mistreater, whatever that's ended up, something else. We did, I can't remember, a few others anyway. And it was that, the demo was brought over to London by Eamon, and Steve had done then the logo, you know, the yellow zigzaggy logo, as a little wraparound package, and the record label loved the logo, weren't so happy with the demo, you know.
Right.
So it was the logo that got us the deal, I think.
Right.
Really.
Well done, Steve.
And it just took off from there.
So he rang us up and said, you know, I'll come over and re-record the songs, and if we can live up to the cover, we'll give you a deal.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's what we did.
Good. And Kitty, did you recorded some demos with Heat Record. Was that Jude Carr's? No?
Yeah, no, we never recorded anything, you know. It used to kind of piss me off, because
right.
I think we were, like, pretty good.
Oh, that's right,
because
Heat went under, or they weren't able to finance. Are there not recordings of you guys, no, that were never released?
Well, we had a couple of attempts at recording things, and the first recording session ended up... We ended up having to get bailed out by Bill Graham. And it all went a bit pear-shaped. And so the second, I don't know, there was another recording. That's all a bit of a blur, really, you know. But there was a tape
somewhere.
I do have a demo. I have a tape, and I remember some guy in the magnet just recorded it on a cassette.
Yeah.
And he can hear all the voices and everyone talking in the audience. And then we got an interview with... Dave Fanning on Radio Dublin, and he said, "You got a demo?" I was like, yeah, here you go. And he just put it on, and we were chatting away.
Yeah.
And we were having a bit of... We were telling the music he was playing was shit, and we wanted to play different records. So it was all this happening there. He wasn't listening to the tape, and then he puts headphones on. He goes, "Holy shit." You know, it was so awful, you know. It was really funny.
And like people like Eamon, are there like characters, those sort of behind the scene characters that made things happen? Who else was there that maybe we mightn't be aware of that were sort of pushing things from the back?
There's a whole generation of people that came through, like, you know, with the bands and the I mean, I had my own radio show on Radio Dublin, believe it or not, where I used to record at home. I interviewed a band called Revolver. And play the sort of track. So yeah, we're all sort of actively involved. So the whole generation, like the Hot Press came through. Pirate radio, I don't think has ever been given the credit it deserves,
yeah.
You know, in terms of getting our music. Because, you know, if you were trying to get a punk record, never mind a punk record, any rock record played on RTE, all you had was one radio station, and Larry Golden had a programme for about an hour in the evening, and that was your lot.
Mm-hmm.
But now, our first national exposure, believe it or not, on radio, was on the CBS-sponsored programme on RTE. So they had this little, they bought a 15-minute ad,
yeah.
And then they would play the, you know, the CBS products, which is now Sony, of course. But so they set up CBS Ireland, who released the single television screen and the album in Ireland. Jackie Hayden was the boss there, so he set up an interview with us with Larry Golden. Larry interviewing the Dublin punks, and I have it on tape. And we come across this. Hello, Larry. It's great to be on your show. And we got a new single called Television Screen, and we're Irish punks, and we're singing like that, and it's really, really funny. And we thought it was great. we were just so excited, but because we were Irish punks.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, indeed. And how did, like, both from your experiences of going across the UK touring or whatever, how did British punk compare to Irish punk? What were the differences?
British punk was absolute shit.
Kitty?
I used to go up to Belfast a lot. I used to live in a squat in London with Rudy from the north. And really, then they were completely much more sort of poppy kind of punk. But yeah, so I used to go up and down to the Harp Bar a lot and see the bands up there. And it was interesting, someone's mentioned earlier that there was no women up the north so much that I can think of. Yeah, it was strange because there were so many bands up there,
yeah.
And it was so cool and such a different kind of sound and quite different from what's happening in England. But what used to happen in London was they used to get a lot of harassment, they used to get arrested a lot. Yeah,
okay.
As soon as I heard the Northern Irish accent in the mid 70s, it was off to the cells.
Right.
But to be honest, a lot of the well-known British punk bands that had already been signed to the major labels at this stage, like the Pistols.
Sure.
Yeah, we did quite a few gigs actually in the Roundhouse on a Sunday, and 999 were one of the bands that we played with. I thought they were particularly good.
Yeah.
There was a few others, Eater, and you know, Sham 69, I saw them playing. They were good, but they just drew this sort of skinhead crowd that would come in and disrupt their gigs, which is a real shame. So there was some good stuff there, you know, and it was, in the main, it was sort of working class driven.
Right, yeah.
There was
not exclusively, though, for
one
sure.
One particular gig on the first couple of weeks of the tour, where I was, I'd gone over with the band. I wasn't singing at that stage as a kind of tour manager and doing the whole thing.
You sang?
No, I never did. Yeah, I think it was in the Music Machine. And we were headlining over a band called New Hearts, wasn't it?
They were signed to a big label,
and they were on Sony or whatever, and you know, they were kind of bitching that we were headlining, and they should have been headlining the whole thing, and all, there was a lot of punks at the bar, and they were all looking at this band, they were all kind of Irish band, crap band. So we did our set, and they began to take some interest, and then at the end of the set, we brought Johnny Thunders on stage, and their mouths just dropped, they couldn't believe it, and Johnny was absolutely incredible. He played four songs with the band, and you know, he would have played more, only Jimmy didn't really understand the idea of jamming. It wasn't something that he'd ever done. He just played drums to distract tracks that we'd done. But Johnny was great. He was in great form. He was off the drugs at that stage.
He said, "Fuck you, British punks."
And he blew up Pete's amp, so it was, must have been a great
gig. Yeah, he did. It was delightful.
And what about like outside Dublin, Belfast and Derry, when you're touring the, you know, smaller towns? What was the
reception? Did a gig in the ballroom. We did a gig, and it, you know, the show bands had vacated the ballrooms. They'd gone into the sort of chicken and basket sort of lounges. So we did this, the Radiators from Space did a gig in a ballroom. So you arrived, huge big ballroom, and we played to maybe 15 people in a big ballroom. And, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, for about 45 to 50 minutes. And at the end of each song, it was just complete nothing.
Sorry.
At the very end of the gig, we went out to the bar, and there was these young kids, and we said, they said, "That was amazing. Why didn't you respond? What would you do to that sort of music? We've never heard music like that before. Yeah. What'd you do to that?" So we said, "Well, you hop up and down like a pogo stick and spit at the band, and you put a little collar around your neck and a little short collar chained, and you put that around your girlfriend's neck, and you jump up and down choking each other, spitting at the band. Sorry, we've got to go now." I always wondered, wherever the next band that went there, they just got this deluge of spit on them.
Yeah. Kitty, what was your experience?
I still haven't finished. What I was going to say, I'm serious now, for us, we were like musical missionaries. You know, we really were like bringing. If you went to the West Coast in those days, they didn't have a clue what was going on in Dublin. Do you know what I mean? Sorry.
Thanks, Pete.
We weren't like missionaries.
Yeah. Mission position.
No, definitely not. Yeah. So we did a tour around Ireland, and I just remember one particular gig. It was down in Carlow, and being up on the stage, and there was a big hole in the stage, and so they put a big carpet over it. You couldn't see the hole. There was Ito on the drums and the guitars, so I was just sort of having to try not to fall down this hole for the whole gig. And I said, I was concentrated on that so much that for the whole tour, that's what I remember really most. So not trying to fall down the hole. But we had about 15 people in the audience as well, but mad enthusiastic. About five of them were just going mental.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So the main thing I remember about that tour is, we were all travelling down in one little van. I think there was a few bands in the one van, and we were drinking little stubbies, and I had to go to the loo. So they pulled over, the van over, ran into a field, and they were saying, "Hurry up, hurry up." And I didn't look, and I sat down to have a pee on a big bunch of stinging nettles.
Oh.
Right, internal.
Oh, dear.
Oh, Jesus, I was on stage.
Michael Jackson.
Yeah. Yeah, I probably was doing that before.
Steve, your own memories of travelling the highways and byways of,
well, there's a couple of strange ones. We played a biker bar in Carlow called El Rodeo, and it was one of those bars where the stage is at the end of the bar, and the audience is out there, and you can't, the dressing room is down the other end of the thing. So they came in and they were really kind of aggressive, and we went on, and Phil said, "Well, let's give them as good as we get." So we got very, very heavy, very aggressive in the whole thing. At the end, they all came up and they hugged us and said, "You're the first band that's actually given it back to us." And they thought it was great, and they sort of rated. And the other one was, we played a gig in, Kilcon, was it? In a marquee. It was booked for horses.
The first gig we did after the Belfield incident, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in a marquee, and Horses were booked to play the night, and Horses had a rule in their contract, they wouldn't play any more marquee gigs because they found them disastrous. So we were the only band that wasn't booked for them. holiday weekend. So we went down, and it was great fun because it was a fun fair. It was a big wheel on Dodgems, so we spent the whole day on Dodgems, and we sort of got ready, and they said, and we had a big poster outside, like Dickie Rock, something else. The Radiators from Space, Ireland's first punk band, and another show band the night afterwards. So
I like Dickie Rock.
Yeah, he was good.
Spit at me, Dickie.
Exactly.
Long before punk.
yes, exactly. We went on, we did the set, and we were about five songs into the set, giving it as best we could. And a guy comes walks on the stage and puts his hand up. And I said, what's going on here? And he says, I've got to do the raffle now. So he goes out and he starts reading the raffle. And we all go to the side of the stage. And this trio of three nuns comes on stage with plates of sandwiches for the band, which is obviously what they did with the show bands.
Oh.
So here we are, in chains, eating these little sandwiches. And then we went on and did the rest of the set.
Yeah.
But like you were saying, it was about 10, 15 kids in the front who were really doing that, and all the rest looking at you like the spacemen, you know.
Yeah.
If any nun stepped on stage when I was playing, I tell you, boot in a hole.
Yeah,
well, I mean, that's the Pete Townsend thing when he did Woodstock, and this guy came up to give a political protest, so we booted him off the stage. He says, nobody gets on my stage when I'm playing.
There you go. Okay, so here we are, 2017, 40 years on, and there's a new Radiators album.
Well,
a Trouble Pilgrims album.
Trouble Pilgrims album,
sorry.
Yes.
Yes. And it's coming, tell us a bit about the end of October.
Probably the last week in October. I think we're looking at 27th of October.
And wonderfully, things have come full circle and it's on Ace.
It's on Ace,
with,
yeah.
Back
again.
With Ted.
It's actually on Chiswick Records.
Chiswick
Records. My Ace.
As we were.
I think it's come full circle for me too. I'm doing absolutely fucking nothing.
No, I was just about to say, Kitty, we need to hear some recorded music from you.
I always wanted to do that.
No, tell us. You have to, what projects do you have coming up that we can keep an eye out for?
Shit stirring.
Okay.
Protesting.
So you good.
All over the news today.
Yeah. Looking
you
good.
Know, just. I think that. Much as I love music and I'm a fucking awesome singer, it's quite a tragedy that I'm not doing anything, actually.
But, there's got to be a young punk band out there that needs a good singer.
Yeah. Why not tempt it, never miss it?
I do like subverting the media and doing all that sort
we
of
did
thing,
work
like
together,
videos.
We did work together post-Radiators.
We were in
an electronic band.
Yeah. Yeah.
Simon's so Monitors, isn't that it?
That was
tell us a bit about that.
I got kicked out of the Boy Scouts and then I joined Steve and we were doing electronic music and the first gig we did together was in McGonagall's and I also remember we were wearing white cowboy shirts.
Yeah.
It looked like some uniform for McDonald's and we had red baseball caps, white cowboy shirts, black pants. And we came out on stage, there was no guitars, and there was loads of punks in the audience because it's Steve and myself.
Yeah.
And they were all like that, and there was no guitars, they were going, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah.
And it was just synthesizers. And then we went, 1, 2, 3, 4, do, a deer, a female deer.
Yeah.
We sang this fucking sound of music.
We were kind of taking the Devo thing.
Yeah.
Looking the same. So we all walked on the front stage and all did like that in a row and then went to the instruments and played it.
And then we had some original songs and
songs, yeah.
Piece of My Heart.
Yeah.
It was quite an unusual mix. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And then I always remember this punk guy coming up to me afterwards and he looked like he was about to weep and he goes, how could you?
Well, we played before Cathy joined, was myself and Paul and Dermot was as a trio, a three piece, and we played with the Outcasts, and that was a gig we thought we were in Belfield. We were all going to get killed at that gig because of all these punks with chains and everything, and the Outcasts audience was kind of real hardcore.
Mm.
But we did a half hour set where we played electronic soundtrack to Nosferatu, the Dracula film.
Oh, yeah.
We hung a sheet halfway down the hall and we projected the movie onto the sheet.
Nice.
So the entire audience for the entire set was at their backs to us.
Yeah.
But you know, they loved it. Even the Outcasts came along and said, that's fucking great, because if you want to be a punk, get a synthesizer. You don't have to know how to play anything. You just make lots of noise.
The attitude, not the instrument.
It's industrial and it's heavy and
yeah.
It's, you know,
yeah.
Great, great fun.
Okay, I'm aware, I don't want to go into any other panel's time. So does anyone have any questions for Kitty or Steve or Pete before we wrap up? Anybody? No, everyone's very shy. Okay, I'd like to thank Kitty and Pete and Steve. Thanks
Thank you
so much.